Be seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument in 10-0513, Matthew Washerman, MD, versus Christina Google.
May it please the court, Williamson will present argument for the petitioner. The sheriff deserves 7 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The question, or one of the questions that we're here to address today, is are we going to require plaintiffs who bring a health care liability claim against a doctor to comply with Chapter 74's requirements that demand or require an expert's report?
So the amicus brief suggests that if this court were to follow the holding in the Fifth Circuit, in the Vanderwoof case, that it would allow the doctor, or allow the medical health profession, to use the statute as a shield and hide behind alleged sexual assaults, and then it also defeats the purpose of the statute.
Your Honor,
agree with that?
I would disagree with that. The purpose of the statute is to have someone, as you noted in a dissent recently in the Omaha case, it has have an expert in the same area, the same field, look at what the allegations are, look behind the labels of an intentional tort, and determine whether this did or did not meet the standards of care.
Well, let me ask you this. What was the medical care or the service to be rendered on the day of the assault?
On the day that she says that she was assaulted, she was there, according to her petition, to come back and address the MRI.
Do you disagree that it was for a surgical consult?
Your Honor, it was a consult where she says that she left the MRI there the day before and came back to address what was there for the MRI.
Well, let's just assume that it was a surgical consult. Tell me, what is the relationship between the alleged injury and this defendant's professional medical judgment? What is the relationship?
The relationship between Dr. Wasserman's decision was that he visited with her about the MRI that he had reviewed. He talked to her again about the issues she was complaining about. And it is within his realm as a medical professional to determine whether he needs to ask her more questions, whether he needs to revisit some of those. It's clear from reading her petition, she didn't even understand what was being asked.
So are you saying there was more that she went to that office that day for than a surgical consult reviewing that MRI?
We have to accept what she's got in her petition for purposes of this hearing. And she says for a surgical consult, he had then, though, looked at the MRI. She says that she went back for a consult, but she's taken to an examination room, a meeting room.
I'm sorry. What was the professional medical judgment that he was supposed to exercise that day?
He is supposed to, as an orthopedic surgeon, try to determine the origin and the source of the pain and the numbness that she complained
about. That day, the day of the alleged assault, what was his professional medical judgment that he was going to exercise that day?
He was attempting to understand the origin and the source and the cause of her pain and her numbness.
Then what is the relationship between this alleged injury to that judgment?
The alleged injury, her
to
claim
that
of sexual assault?
Judgment, to that judgment, yeah, because what is the relationship between the sexual assault, without going into the details, and that defendant's professional medical judgment that he was going to exercise that day?
Well, Your Honor, he asked her questions about where she was experiencing pain. She described pain and numbness from her lower back all the way down to her shins and in her knees, basically the lower part of her body. And he's going through and attempting, once again, to determine the origins and the source of that pain.
Can I get one hypothetical? And then let me ask you a hypothetical. If a doctor conducts a regular physical exam and somewhere during that exam decides to shoot the patient in the head, is that a medical malpractice case?
No, Your Honor, shooting someone in the head, I don't think that
it's
you can separate
from sexually assault. That crime is different from the crime of sexual assault?
Well, Your Honor, that's what they've labeled this, as a sexual assault, and as this court has recognized in many of the cases dealing with Chapter 74 and the expert reports, you have to go behind the labels that are identified in the petition. And if you read her petition, she claims, someone with, I think, a ninth grade education, claims that she thought that his questions on the second day were unnecessary. She thought his exam on the second day was unnecessary.
Well, presume it is undisputed that what happened was a sexual assault. Would it then have to be brought under Chapter 74?
It is inseparable. What he did, what she claims he did, is inseparable from the treatment, the ongoing treatment that he was, or the examination that he was doing of her.
Okay, let me ask you something. Is there anything that a doctor can do during a medical examination that would not require an expert report?
Yes, Your Honor.
What would that be?
Shooting someone in the head, for example, would be a good example of something that is separable from what they stop doing, what they're supposed to be doing. They deviate at that point from what they're supposed to be doing.
And where do you draw the line then?
You draw the line by using an expert report in this particular case.
No, the question is whether you need an expert report. And so where do you draw the line?
Your Honors, this court has recognized you draw the line from looking at the allegations. And in this case, the allegations are that he was performing an exam on her. She disagrees with some aspects of the exam, but we're not talking about she walks in for an eye exam and suddenly he rapes her, or she walks in for a dental appointment and he grabs her breast. This is a situation where this doctor is asking her pressure points, pain points, and only another expert in this field, in this particular
But you're hypothetical about the dentist groping a patient. You would concede that is not a Chapter 74 claim.
And if the dentist just gropes the patient and he's supposed to be working on her teeth, no, that would not be a Chapter 74 claim. If, however, the dentist gives that patient anesthesia and the patient reacts to it and the doctor has to revive the patient, then that would be a part of his course of treatment. He might have to pound her on the chest. He might have to yank her up.
How would the expert report read? Sexual assault deviates from the standard of care, or how would that report read from your perspective? I mean, what would it really say, assuming this was a sexual assault?
Your Honor, in this particular case, there is no sexual assault. You have to have an expert
But that's not her question. Her question is, what would the expert report have said had your stance been correct, if you're right? What would it have said?
The expert report would describe what he did as necessary in order to determine what was the origin of the pain and the numbness, to again go with her and walk her through what is going on in terms of these pressure points and these areas where she's describing from her lower back all the way almost down to her feet, her lower extremities, her lower part of her body. It would describe what he needed to do. Was it within the standard of care? Did he deviate from the standard of care?
Can we just use some common sense here? I mean, obviously I'm not a doctor. None of us are here, I don't think. But this is not a gynecologist. This just seems so beyond the pale to what this doctor allegedly did that, you know, common sense would tell you you don't need an expert report.
That's the reason we need an expert report, because as we pointed out in our brief, there is a condition called, and I can't hardly pronounce it, it's called bulbocavernous reflex, which would require, and I've talked to neurologists and orthopedic surgeons who say that you do insert your finger into a vagina, or with a male, you do squeeze certain parts of their genitalia.
That's almost illogical. He's going to tell her she doesn't need surgery. He's done the exam the day before. On the day that he's going to tell her she doesn't need surgery, he suddenly thinks it's appropriate to insert his fingers in her.
Your Honor, he's certainly going to say it was medically necessary and that he did not deviate from the standards of care, because she is describing for him additional pain, additional numbness, different symptoms than she described the day before. That is what he's going to say, is that she came in with different symptoms the next day, different complaints the next day, and having had the advantage of looking at the MRI and talking with her about those symptoms and the pain and the numbness, he went ahead and started doing the pressure points again. It is not for the court, it is not for the plaintiff or her attorney to say whether it was medically necessary or not. It is for the expert.
So that is an inseparable part of his medical judgment going on to the other things that he allegedly did to her.
That's what he will say, and that's what an expert will say. That's the reason why you start off with an expert report. That doesn't mean at the end of the day that the experts are going to be agreeing with him, that this won't morph into an assault claim, but at this point, it is a health care liability claim.
Let's assume it is an assault claim. Does the treatment end at the point it becomes a sexual assault? Because I think the statute uses the words during. So was this really during the rendition of the services, or does that treatment end at the time it progresses into a sexual assault? When does the treatment end? When is it no longer during?
If it were truly a sexual assault, he would then be deviating from his giving her treatment and care and evaluating and assessing
her. He would be committing a crime, wouldn't he, if it was...
Exactly. And if a patient dies on the operating room table and a plaintiff claims it's murder, it doesn't make it murder. It doesn't make it a crime. You need an expert report to be able to assess what happened on that operating room table.
Ms. Williamson, under Chapter 74, it defines health care liability claim as a departure from accepted standards of in four different areas: medical care, health care, safety, I think five, professional or administrative services. Which of those does the plaintiff claim to fall under? The courts of appeals cases and a lot of the briefing in this area tend to generally say healthcare liability claim without being specific as to which part of the statute their claim falls under. What do you understand the plaintiff's case to be alleged as? Medical care, health care, safety, professional, or administrative services?
My understanding is medical care, Your Honor.
Medical care?
What do you make of the amici's point that essentially we're sort of, were we to allow this to be, or say it had to be brought as a Chapter 74 claim, you're essentially turning a medical exam room into a safe haven for battery and assault?
Your Honor, my response to that is doctors have to touch patients, unless you're a psychiatrist or a psychologist. That's just part of the risk of being a doctor. So what they're claiming, the reverse is, it turns any examination that a doctor does into a potential assault claim, sexual or otherwise, because a doctor is going to touch their patients.
Well, I think they're concerned that a Dr. Wasserman can get away with what a Mr. Wasserman could not.
Your Honor, at the end of the day, if they prove that it was an assault, they get to where they want to go anyway. What we're saying here is that they had to start off with the premise of an expert report as mandated by Chapter 74. And had they started off there, we might not be here today, because their expert may have said this was totally necessary. It was totally within the realm of what you would do in an examination like this. And if I were her treating physician, I would have done the same thing. We don't know, because they didn't comply with the statute.
Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Williamson. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. McCamey will present argument for the respondent. Mr. Kaiser will present argument for the amicus. Mr. McCamey will open with the first 10 minutes.
May it please the court. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
What the petitioner wants you to do is to eliminate the trial court function of determining whether a health care liability claim exists by having a blanket rule that if it occurs in the medical examination room, it's a health care liability claim.
Well, it seems to me that's where the cases have been going.
Well, the legislature did not create a blanket rule, because they defined what a health care liability claim is so that the judiciary would have a guide when looking at these cases. If the legislature wanted a blanket rule, they could have said whatever occurs in the examination room is a health care liability claim.
Do you think that there are any instances when an expert report would be necessary to determine whether an alleged sexual assault departed from accepted standards of medical care?
I think that each situation has to be determined based upon the facts of that case, on the allegations of that case. And there may be some that require a report. I think it depends on the allegations of the case.
And what makes this different from the times when it would be required?
The actual facts of the case make it different. Here we had an examination the day before the consult was to occur. She went to the consult the next day. He told her from the examination I gave you yesterday and the MRI, this is what needs to be done. You do not need surgery. He then departed from the provision of medical services, walked her into an examination room, and closed the door.
Hold on, you say he departed from medical services. I'm gonna jump back to Justice Wainwright's question. Which specific subpart, which part of the definition of healthcare liability claim is your client suing under?
She's not suing under any of these. She has said this was an assault.
I understand. Which one of those parts of the definition? And for example, let me rephrase it this way. Healthcare liability claim is defined statutorily as a claimed departure from accepted standards of medical care or healthcare, dot, dot, dot. Do you disagree that an assault like this departs from accepted standards of healthcare and medical care, dot, dot, dot?
Yes. I don't believe this was a departure from a healthcare services. To believe this was a departure from the healthcare services, one would have to believe that a person can digitally assault someone, smell his finger, call her on the telephone after he did this, request that she see him at a hotel, call her later on and ask her if he can meet her at her sister-in-law's house. And one would have to believe all of those things are a departure from medical care. Well, and they are not.
Under 13, though, the definition of health care liability claim also, the dot, dot, dot says, or administrative services directly related to health care. Can you give a little more of your views on how this is not directly related to health care?
It is clearly, in my opinion, not related to health care services. When he starts calling, and one of the things that this court has said is that in a DiversiCare case, the court has said that there may be circumstances that give rise to, in this case, premises liability claims in a healthcare setting that may not be properly classified as healthcare liability claims. And to get back to your question, in this situation, when he, and looking at the totality of the circumstances, when he started calling her at home, saying, I want to do to you what I did in the examination room, we now know that was not medical care. That was not the provision of medical services.
Was that part of the criminal charges that were there were some related criminal charges, were there not?
She taped the conversations because the sheriff's department asked her to tape the conversations. No criminal charges came of that. So that information came from those from trying to create or make the criminal case for the sheriff's department.
What if there's what if the other evidence doesn't come in for whatever reason, and the only testimony is what occurred in the examination room? Would a medical expert report be required for that?
No, I don't think so. Not under the facts of this situation. And I think it's important that we look at what this court has said regarding the cases in DiversiCare, that each case in DiversiCare, the court said, the determination of whether a cause of action is a health care liability claim requires an examination of the claim's underlying nature. And I think when you look at the underlying nature of this claim, a health care report would not be necessary. And I don't think that the legislature wanted a blanket rule, or else they would have said, whatever happens in the examining room.
What do you think the rule should be? Because sometimes doctors do have to touch people. And in most instances, if a stranger did that, it would be at least an assault and maybe a sexual assault. So what should be the rule that distinguishes between the part of treatment, legitimate part of treatment, and something that's across the line?
Absolutely, doctors have to touch people. But in a case such as this, and each case has to, you have to look at the underlying nature of the claim. In a case such as this, when the examination had been done the day before, right, and the consult, Justice Guzman.
Let me interrupt you there. Does that really matter to you that it happened the day after? I mean, wouldn't you have the same complaint if this had happened the first day?
Well, I think it makes it more clear here. And I think Justice Guzman asked a very good question. What was supposed to happen that day? What was supposed to happen that day was a consult. She was supposed to come in and merely be told whether she needed surgery.
And along those lines, what we actually said in DiversiCare was a cause of action alleges a departure from accepted standards of medical care or health care if the act or the omission complained of is an inseparable part of the rendition of medical services. What do you contend is the medical service to be rendered that day?
The medical service to be rendered that day, our allegation is that it was a consult. She was merely to be there to be told whether she was going to need surgery or not.
Counsel, since your time is winding down, I don't know if you got a chance to finish Justice Heck's question about what the principle should be in determining when it is and when it's not, and I'm interested in that answer as well.
Yes. I think you have to look at each individual case. Each individual case has to be looked at. The trial court has to act as a gatekeeper. It has to use its traditional role as a gatekeeper and look at each individual case. And I think when they look at the case, if it's a sexual assault, and that's what we're saying happened here, it's a sexual assault, no report is needed. And it's almost, I guess somebody on the Supreme Court said, I don't know what...
Obscenity.
Excuse me?
Obscenity
is, but I know it when I see it. I think it's one of those situations.
Well, and how important is the rendition of medical services to that analysis or to inform the trial court of that question? Those words from DiversiCare, the rendition of medical services, how important is that?
I think it's absolutely key and critical that when you can separate the assault from the rendition of medical services, then a report is not necessary.
Mr. McKamey, I agree we have to take cases as they come. You know, they're all very fact-specific and they're all very distinguishable. But of course, you know, this court, we have to make a decision that applies across 254 counties from border to border. And I guess one question I have, and it kind of goes along the lines of Justice Heck's question on kind of the overarching principle that we ought to be aiming for here is, we have to be mindful that our ruling applies statewide, and touching of patients does occur, it has to occur, it must occur, it is indispensable. So what would be the principle that would permit appropriate touching, but also not encourage lawsuits based on subjective misinterpretations of inappropriate touching? I mean, how should we balance that?
Yes, I think when there is a clear intrusion into the personal space, such as here, and where there are clear indications that it was not the provision of medical services, such as in this case, where he called her after it happened, where he smelled his finger after it happened.
I understand the very forceful facts of this case,
yes.
But we have to apply, you know, generally. I'm just wondering where the dividing line is between recognizing the need for appropriate touching, but also not encouraging suits based on subjective misinterpretations of what they consider inappropriate, but it's tough.
Bearing in mind that in any of those types of examinations, the activity or the conduct is going to be very intrusive.
Yes.
So I don't know that that really answers it.
And I don't think that you can do a blanket rule. I think that you have to say that, as you said in DiversaCare, that it requires an examination of the claims, the underlying nature. And when you look at the totality of the facts in a particular situation, I think that's when you determine whether the report was needed or not.
Do we need to write a new rule, or does DiversaCare inform our decision in this case sufficiently so that we don't need to articulate a brand new rule, a new bright line rule?
I think DiversaCare articulates it sufficiently. I think the court needs to clarify it for the appellate courts. And I truly believe that if you come down with just one hard rule, that will not work for the state of Texas.
Are there any further questions? Thank you,
thank you,
Mr. McHaney.
May it please the court. Sexual assault is sexual assault, regardless of where it occurs or who perpetrates it.
Well, how do you know if someone's gynecological examination is a sexual assault? I mean, clearly that's a sexual assault under some circumstances, but clearly it is not under other circumstances.
And that's
how do we know the difference?
Justice Johnson, you find out by engaging in the analysis that this court laid down in DiversaCare versus Rubio to examine the underlying nature of the claim.
And this claim, she sued a doctor that she had gone to for treatment, and she was in the office for a follow-up visit, and the question is exactly how far does the doctor's treatment go during the follow-up visit?
Exactly.
And so how do we know that from the pleadings, which is what we say we look at? How do we differentiate?
So let me use an example. I would analogize to the case that the 13th Court of Appeals decided in Christus Bond versus Sanchez. In that case, the court rightly noted that it does not view the injurious conduct alleged in isolation, not just in a vacuum, but instead it considers it in the context of the surrounding circumstances. Recall in Sanchez, the plaintiff was a patient who had been sedated in bed in a hospital and alleged that she had been sexually assaulted by two nurses. But in addition to that claim, she also alleged facts like that one of the nurses tried to climb into bed with her while she was sedated, and they danced with her in the hospital room, and they made lewd comments to her and wrote a note on a dry erase board that said, "I love you." And in that case, the 13th Court of Appeals had little trouble determining that in the context of the surrounding circumstances, the alleged sexual assault was just that and had absolutely nothing to do.
What if there are no surrounding circumstances?
Pardon me, Justice.
What if there are no surrounding circumstances? Just what happened in the examination room, one incident, could be a sexual assault as claimed by one side, perhaps not as claimed by the other side.
And admittedly, that is a much more difficult case. And I think that that's the complication that Vanderwerf presents.
In a gynecological exam, the example just used, would a woman know or understand the difference between an exam and a sexual assault, and when it goes and progresses further than an exam?
Perhaps not always.
Such to be able to plead that?
Perhaps not always. And I take no issue with the existence of Chapter 74's expert report requirement. There will no doubt be some cases where a sexual assault will be alleged, but in fact it was part of medical services unbeknownst to the patient. Likewise, there will be cases in which a sexual assault was perpetrated, but the healthcare provider cast them artfully as part of the rendition of medical care.
What about a case where the sexual assault is pled, alleged, and the defendant maybe doesn't contest it? Maybe that falls into the category that we're talking about here. Or a case where the assault is alleged and the defendant flatly denies it. One case is a healthcare liability case and the other one is not.
Was the form, I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand the two types of cases.
Well, here. I mean, it's allegation. So the allegation, if the allegation exists of a sexual assault in the course of a medical examination, then that takes it out of a healthcare liability context.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why I think.
But if the defendant flatly denies it, so that never happened. In that event, it may clearly be a healthcare liability case in terms of what the true facts are, but because the allegation is made, it takes it out of that category?
I believe so. Okay. And I think that's why the court in Vanderwerf would have been within its rightful discretion to not dismiss the case for failure to file an expert report requirement.
But then, just to follow up on that, if it should be determined later in the case that the extra allegations were false, they just don't bear out, then there's no question about it. There was a videotape of the room and it shows it just didn't happen. Then it's too late to file an expert report and the claim is just dismissed, I suppose.
But yeah, right. In that case, it would just be a dismissed lawsuit for sexual assault.
Does the association get reports about things like this, or is there
Absolutely.
A database of this kind of occurrence?
In my day-to-day job, what I do is take calls. I basically sit by the phone and take calls from Rape Crisis Center advocates and survivors alike. What I can tell you is that what we know about sexual predators, which is what this case is about, it's not just about healthcare providers, but about sexual predators who happen to be healthcare providers. And what we know about healthcare, or about sexual predators who happen to occupy positions of power, like doctors, employers, landlords, clergy members, lawyers, what we know about those specific predators is that they conscientiously exploit their positions of power relative to their victims in order to facilitate their assaults. And that's what makes this case so especially important for sexual assault survivors, and really the reason that I'm here this morning as amicus, is to emphasize how particularly unjust the petitioner's position would be
in
the specific context.
We understand that, and those are egregious. There are egregious circumstances. But in this case, say the pleading, say someone goes in for a scheduled exam of some nature, and what they plead is they during the time they feel it didn't go as well as they thought, and their pleading is, I went in to see the doctor and I was sexually assaulted and I'm suing them for X number of dollars and all that. It seems as though the requirement of an expert report aids the trial court, because the expert then goes through the medical records and takes statements that may have been made and goes through the treatment, and it actually helps the trial court determine those matters. Whereas otherwise you just have bald allegations and we have to go forth with the lawsuit and develop all of that, which is part of what the legislature is tried to curtail by requiring an expert report. You get a third party to look at all of these facts and tell the trial court something.
I acknowledge that, and I don't dispute that specifically, but I think that that's not the whole story. And the reason for that is that another thing that we know about sexual predators, which is what we're talking about here, is that they purposely choose victims who they perceive as vulnerable.
Let me ask you, isn't it true that in medical exams of this nature, that typically a doctor is going to have a third party present in order to protect the physician?
I would presume that would be a best practice, but that would be a presumption on my part. I don't know what the medical standards are.
In terms of the breadth of the definition of healthcare liability claim, medical care, health care, safety, professional administrative services. How broad do you think safety is?
I think safety would extend to the kind of situation that this court considered in DiversiCare, a failure to protect one patient from another.
DiversiCare held that that situation was medical care or health
right.
care.
When the plaintiff is suing the facility or the employer.
And then later, at the end, safety as well. But that wasn't the focus of DiversiCare. So it's more about medical care and health care. How far do you think safety extends?
I think safety would be things like you know, leaving a sponge in someone's body while during surgery, keeping a person from slipping on a sponge, moving from one room to another, kind of things that are more closely related to premises liability, except you're dealing with a patient, and there's the physician-patient relationship. When you stop providing medical services, when you stop rendering medical services, and then in the middle of medical services, choose to commit an intentional tort, or in this case, a second degree felony, that is no longer a departure from standards of safety. That's just a crime.
Well, there's an argument that by putting safety in the statute, that it may have been intended to, at least there's an argument, that while, for example, a patient is in a hospital, perhaps in a weakened condition, that there's an obligation to keep them safe from slipping on a sponge, from you know, perhaps a Coke machine on the floor falling on them. At least there's an argument that that's so. It's not just related to healthcare, or it may be related to healthcare. That's why I'm asking you how far safety goes. Does it go as far as protecting against assaults?
I could accept that, and I think that that's what's most important to me is that, regardless of how that's resolved, even if we say that safety encompasses all of that, what it can't include is the intentional decision by a healthcare provider to commit the assault.
I mean, I guess the question is, can safety be defined such that part of being safe is for a doctor not to commit sexual assault?
I think that is what the court in Holgan and so many others have said would defy logic.
Well, we have held also, I think it was a Marks case where it was a healthcare provider case, and that the export report, I suppose, would look like a building maintenance somebody coming up with a report saying that these bolts should have been tightened down a little bit more to keep the footboard from falling off. It seems to me if the court is in the direction of that, why wouldn't it seem logical that in a circumstance such as this, that an export report would be required to show that either this was or was not a service of health care at the time?
Because I think that if trial judges are in the position to do anything, it is to exercise what Justice Medina referred to as common sense. If you have facts, especially as egregious as in this case or Sanchez, a judge is in perfect position to look at that and say, I don't need an expert to tell me that what this healthcare provider did was not part of the rendition of medical care, and in fact had nothing to do with medical or professional judgment. It was just an intentional tort, and that isn't within the common knowledge of the general public.
Well, let me say, we recently held that in a spider bite case that, in fact, an expert report was required. How is this different?
Who was the defendant in that case?
It was a doctor, right? Yeah, I mean, it was a hospital thing.
I think that it becomes different when the healthcare provider is failing to protect from some other third party, if you can call a spider a party. It's different when you're alleging that the doctor himself committed the act to the patient, made a conscious decision to commit an intentional tort or a felony.
So if there had been a lawsuit filed against the employer of Dr. Wasserman, would that be encompassed as a healthcare liability claim as opposed to suing him directly?
For example, alleging
and,
that
and the, for his conduct in this case,
alleging that they should have protected the patient from him. Mm-hmm. I think that's how I read DiversiCare. Yes.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
The court will hear a rebuttal.
Ms. Williamson, may I ask you one question?
Yes, Your Honor.
On page 14 of your brief, You talk about how the justices on the 14th Court of Appeals, that you've looked at their bios and they don't have any medical expertise, and how would they know that this touching or inserting the finger was not medically necessary as a matter of law? So my question is, there's been some discussion this morning about considering the circumstances and the facts pled. Should those inform the analysis? This is a very unique case in some ways, and it is in the context of coming back a second day after an initial exam. So how do you think we should consider the circumstances? How should they inform our analysis?
I'm sorry.
Should they ever matter? Should it ever matter that it was the second day of the exam, that she'd gone through a full exam the first day, that she alleges that he told her he was going to do only the surgical consult? So does all that matter? Should that inform our analysis? Or should we just say, well, you judges are not doctors, what do you know?
Your Honor, in this situation, no, it should not. And you know, unless there's a clear deviation, it should not. Because what we have here is the need for someone who is trained in this area, who knows what is appropriate and inappropriate in terms of what he was doing and whether he should have examined her again the next day.
And a quick follow-up, I left out the phone calls, if it's true, the phone calls and telling her I want to do it again. I'm sorry, should we consider that? Should that inform the analysis?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, that's not what's pled. What's pled in this case is that he called
her. I mean, assume
her.
That it's true. Should we consider that?
Let's just assume it had been that it's pled. True.
Yeah.
So, assuming it was pled? Yeah. No, Your Honor, because he is attempting to arrange appointments with her for medical care because she has, for lack of a better word, poor-mouthed him, told him she cannot afford the treatment, she cannot come back, she cannot do this. So it is part of the rendition of the medical services, perhaps the administrative part of that.
So I guess, I'm sorry.
Sure. Was there a pleading that an allegation in the pleadings that the doctor forcibly removed the patient's clothes without her consent?
No, Your Honor. What was pleaded was that when she came in, that he took her sweatpants and he pushed them down a little bit over her pubic area in the beginning, did some poking and prodding. She was not wearing underwear. That's not something that he would have known.
Was there an allegation that she did not consent to that conduct?
I believe that there's an allegation that she did not consent, but once again, that gets back to whether an expert would say that under these circumstances, you would go ahead. She didn't object. I will tell you that. There's nothing in the petition that says she objected. And in fact, following the exam, she had to go to a relative, tell the relative what she says occurred, and let the relative tell her, oh, that's not good, that's bad. So she didn't go back to the referring doctor. She went to a relative who gave her the opinion based upon what Ms. Google told her.
What's the purpose of the statute?
The purpose of the statute, Your Honor, is to weed out claims that are brought against healthcare providers, against doctors, that lack merit, that there should be this threshold issue. This is not even a high threshold, but a threshold issue that before you get to take your claim to court in front of a jury or get to engage in a lot of discovery, that you meet this threshold of whether this treatment, whatever was going on, was medically necessary.
McCamey says that if the legislature intended for all these types of incidents or any incident that occurs inside of a hospital or healthcare facility would be deemed to fall under the statute, it would simply have said so. That seems to make sense to me, and they didn't make that specifically clear.
What they did make clear, Your Honor, is that when you're talking about a situation where, in effect, what she's claiming is that he deviated from the standard of care, that it falls under Chapter 74. She's claiming, I disagree with what he did. He deviated from what he should have been doing. That falls squarely under Chapter 74 and requires an expert report.
Can I ask you, and could you please answer what Justice Heck's question was previously, and that is, what should the rule be?
The rule should be, Your Honor, that in any case involving a healthcare provider or a doctor where there is a claim that something occurred during the course of their treatment, the rendition of that treatment, that they disagree with, that they characterize as an intentional tort, that they ought to with under the Act and provide that report as that threshold. It may change later on, but as a threshold requirement, provide that report. There will be certain circumstances that are black and white. The Justice Guzman's example of someone shooting someone in the head.
So you're saying it would have to be that extreme?
It would have to be a certainty that they stepped outside of what they were supposed to be doing in the rendition of medical services.
Do you agree with the argument that we look at the totality of the circumstances?
Your Honor, I think that in terms of the claim of assault, we look at what happened on that day. In terms of the phone calls, which I will tell you, the petition is different than what he described, and there were no criminal charges. I talked to the police officers. They didn't believe her. You look at that particular situation and then determine whether that particular situation also involved the administrative or rendition of medical services in terms of arranging appointments and payments.
And Dr. Wasserman weren't an orthopedist, but an optometrist, and the allegations were as they are here. What kind of claim would that be?
Your Honor, just from that hypothetical, yep. With nothing more, yep. If he's an optometrist and he is examining her lower extremities, I believe that that's one of those black and white examples. Why would an optometrist or a dentist have any reason to be examining the lower part of a woman's body? An orthopedic surgeon trying to determine the origin of the pain and the source of the pain in the lower part of her body would have that reason.
Well, would you have, let's assume for a moment that she pled in this case. Her pleadings were that she went in for an examination, and while she was in the examination room, he had sexual relations with her. He had intercourse with her. Would at that point your position be that an expert report was necessary?
Your Honor, at that point, no. That's when there is a clear separation in what he was supposed to be doing in terms of rendering professional medical services to her and his own desires, which would be rape.
So to a certain extent, you agree with opposing counsel that you do have to look at the particular circumstances. But in this case, your position is that there is no clear demarcation, and in those cases, an expert report would be necessary?
Your Honor, my point is that you look at the circumstances as they are when they make the complaint, and if they make the complaint that I went in for an eye exam or I went in for an exam and I was raped, that's what occurred on that day. I mean, that's what physically happened. He stopped being her optometrist, her dentist.
And we still go under the pleadings, though.
Yes, Your Honor.
And sexual assault can be more than the actual act of sexual intercourse. So that if that inappropriate touching was sexual assault, it would be no different than had the act been consummated and it was sexual intercourse.
Yes, Your Honor. Sexual assault can be more than just a rape. But when you're dealing with the examination of someone's lower body and you're an orthopedic surgeon trying to determine the origin, there's going to be touching of that area.
Final question, but if the plaintiff had sued the employer, the physician group, or the hospital, or the healthcare entity, for what allegedly happened here, well, let me describe it differently. If it were a more extreme example, you know, a forcible rape or something else, and there was a lawsuit brought against the employer, would that fall under the safety definition of healthcare liability claim and have to be brought as a Chapter 74 claim?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe given the decisions of this court, the Omaha decision and the diversity care decision, whether it's safety or medical care, however it's identified, I believe that the report would be required. And in fact, she did sue the employer in this case. And in fact, it was dismissed because she didn't provide a report.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this morning. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.